In 1969, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People brought a case in North Carolina, the federal court. It came to be known as Swan versus the Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education. This school district was a broad one, sprawling over towns and countryside. It comprised some 550 square miles, nearly 100 schools, some 85,000 students. About 25,000 of the students were black. 21,000 of these black students were in schools in the city of Charlotte. And of these, 14,000 were in schools where the percentage of black to white was over 99-1. The case that was argued against this Board of Education was not simply the traditional Southern case that they had conspired by administrative act and decree to maintain a separate but equal school system, to keep high the walls of segregation. But that since the 1952 landmark decision of the Supreme Court, which had ruled these such systems illegal, the Charlotte Mecklenburg Board had done nothing of a positive nature to undo its history of apartheid. Specifically, they had continued to build new schools in the heart of the black residential areas, rather than to plan these schools on sites on the boundaries of these areas where the school population might have been drawn from a biracial community. The case was argued in the federal court, and the judge in the case agreed with the NAACP contention. He wrote in his decision, "The constitutional guarantee of equal protection demands not simply a negative duty to refrain from active legal discrimination, but a duty to act positively, to fashion affirmatively a school system as free as possible from the lasting effects of historical apartheid." It was now mandated that this school system begin to bus children from various parts of the city of Charlotte in and out of white schools and black schools, so that there would be a gradual building up of a biracial school community in this whole area. In 1971, this case found its way before the Supreme Court. And in a unanimous decision written by the Chief Justice, Mr. Berger, the Supreme Court agreed with the lower court and affirmed the responsibility of school districts and school systems to act positively, to fashion affirmatively programs designed to eliminate racial segregation. A new doctrine had been written into our legal practice, and that is that it was no longer possible for school systems to simply say, "We draw boundaries for our school, and anyone who lives within this boundary comes to his neighborhood school. We make no test as to color. Therefore, we cannot be accused of being segregationist or racist." Now, every action of a major nature undertaken by a school system had to take into consideration as one of the major factors in determining that decision, whether or not the decision in fact encouraged, made possible, the further integration of the student body and teachers and the rest of the people involved in that school district. The protection of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was now extended not only to the Southern systems with their long history of apartheid, of separate equal districts, but to the North, where for the most part there had not been any legal apartheid, any legal action by the schools to maintain racial segregation, but there was a long history of the schools simply accepting passively the racial mix of the neighborhood, arguing that schools are by nature neighborhood-based, and therefore the schools tended to reflect the racial mix of particular neighborhoods. And because of the housing patterns in the North, we had in many of our major northern city schools which were as segregated as any schools had been under the separate but equal practices of the South. And this began the long series of northern cases involving Denver and Dayton and Louisville and Boston and Detroit and now Cleveland, in which the NAACP and other groups have brought to the court the various school systems of the North and argued that they must take significant affirmative action, that they had a positive duty to stimulate and to make possible racial desegregation of the school district. And various remedies were proposed by the various judges who heard these courts and found the school systems liable. Many, if not most, of these remedies have involved busing. Now, there's a difference in the various cases that have been brought in the North. There were some school systems, like the school system in Boston, which simply had argued adamantly since 1969 and 1971 that neighborhood schools were sacrosanct, period, and that it did not accept any responsibility, any positive duty to change the racial mix of the schools. Well, to remember that months before the National Association of the Advancement of Colored People brought the school board of Boston before the court, the state board of education in Massachusetts had already cut off funds from the school system because they were not in compliance with the state interracial schooling act. The Boston board argued adamantly that their schools were open, their hiring practices were desegregated, and that they had no need to take any kind of affirmative action in hiring or affirmative placement in the matter of school population. And so when the situation, the case was brought before the court, it's in a clear adversary condition. There were those who argued the necessity of compliance, and the school system denying that they were not in compliance. But in areas like Detroit and in Cleveland, the confrontation was not as dramatic or as clear. In both situations, the school administration was run by people who had a long history of being activists and being liberals, and the school board itself had very powerful individuals on it who were representatives of the NAACP and of their thinking and power within the black community. It was not a question here of angels on one side and of evil men on the other, but a question raised by the school system as to just how far their responsibilities for affirmative action, for a positive duty to desegregate, went. Paul Briggs, the superintendent of the school system here in Cleveland, has argued and said often that this school system has done all that it could do short of the massive reassignment of pupils through busing in order to bring about desegregation of the system. And he can point to a long list of accomplishments: open hiring of teaching staff, the creation of a number of magnet schools, special interest schools to which children are brought from all areas of the school, of the city, vocational schools, an aeronautic school, engineering centers, arts and science buildings and the like, recreation centers, sports arenas. He can argue that the school has been eager to build into its program a human relations component and has, wherever possible, placed in recent years new schools on site which were at the border of neighborhoods between white neighborhoods and black neighborhoods, or white neighborhoods and Puerto Rican neighborhoods. Now, the NAACP has I have done all that I can, we have done all that we can, component of Dr. Briggs' comment into question. And they have pointed to the continuation in Cleveland of an optional attendance program which allows youngsters, if they will, and if they can manage to get to another school, to opt to go to a special school or to another school, this often encouraging white flight from areas which are increasingly black in school composition. They can point to a number of instances where schools have not been built exactly on borders between biracial areas. But by and large, it's clear that in cities like ours, the school system has raised before the court and is fighting before the court a very serious issue. That is whether they ought to be mandated, given the cost, politically, in terms of the future passage of school levies, economically, in terms of the cost of busing against the school budget, in terms of quality education, whether or not they must be mandated as an affirmative act, as a positive duty, to build into the school system a massive program for the busing of black children into predominantly white neighborhood areas and white children into predominantly black neighborhood areas. We can go so far, the school system is saying, but we cannot go further. They do not disagree with the existence of segregation within the schools. They do not argue that this is simply a matter of the racial housing patterns of Cleveland. They do accept a positive responsibility, but they ask the court to tell them just how far. And it is this general consensus of this general acceptance of the principle of an affirmative duty which led the court to attempt to get both parties, the NAACP and the school board, to agree to a settlement before the case ever reached the court. There's general agreement as to philosophy. There's a general agreement as to purpose. The issue is a pragmatic and practical one. Just how far can we be mandated to go? Just how far can we realistically and practically go? And that's the issue. But precisely, and that is not the issue. The issue before the court is one of law. The issue is one of before the court is specifically this. Is the school system and the state of Ohio liable for having encouraged by its actions or inaction a segregation within the system? If it can be shown by the 31 days of testimony, which are now part of the record, if it has been shown by this testimony that by its actions or inactions in the past, the school system is guilty of having encouraged or made possible segregation within the school, then it stands liable before the law. And then the issue of remedy must arise. And it is when the issue of remedy is arise, after liability has been declared by the court, after the school system has been found liable in part for this condition, it is then and only then that the issue of remedy arises, and it is then that the issue of busing will become part of our concern. The question of busing has not really been raised in these 31 days of testimony, for it's not germane to that issue. It will come up when the court, the school system, and other experts in the NAACP must confront the Cuyahoga River, the black-white color barrier in Cleveland, when they must confront the fact that given the school district, which is the district of the city of Cleveland itself, given the demography of that district, the only way in which one can achieve major desegregation of the schools on the east side and the west side, the black schools on the east side, the white schools on the west side, is by busing the youngsters across town every day. There's no way by building magnet schools or by building schools on the boundaries of biracial areas to achieve any significant desegregation of the black schools and the poor of the east side and the white schools throughout the west side. And inevitably, the question of busing will have to be raised and it will have to be faced. Now, what is the issue of busing? I know a lot of people have a lot of very definite opinions on the subject. And most of these opinions I find innocent of all factual base. It's strange. There are so many people opposed to busing, and yet busing has existed throughout the United States for half a century. And until busing became an issue of race, no one was opposed to it. Every morning as I drive from my home here, I pass any number of orange buses, taking youngsters here and there and everywhere. 35% of all the children in the United States are bused to school every day. And they have been bused to school every day for many, many decades. I know also that in towns like Boston, which have been so adamantly opposed, or school board has been so adamantly opposed to busing, busing has existed as a fact of life within that system for 50 years. Boston was one of the first school systems in the United States to experiment with the existence of special ability schools like Boston Latin School, where children of high intelligence levels, high academic ability, could be brought from all areas of the community and given an education specific to their talent. There are any number of such schools in Boston, and they have had children bused into them for nearly half a century. Busing is not an issue when parents want their children to be bused to that school. Busing becomes an issue only when parents do not want their children to be bused to that school. If my child is not bused to a school that I want him to be bused to, I begin to pound on the doors of the Board of Education. If my child is ordered bused to a school that I do not want him bused to, I end up voting for George Wallace. And that's the sum and substance of it. And the reason that the black community has a perception of the busing group, the anti-busing group, as being racist. They came into being only when the issue of busing to achieve racial integration was raised as a possibility in our land. Then and then only, and not before. It's all right to bus youngsters to give them a vocational education. It's fine to bus youngsters for athletic competition. It's wonderful to bus youngsters who are mentally retarded or have special abilities, but it's wrong to bus youngsters for racial purposes. And that's the illogic of it, and the logic of it. And that's the reason that the black and many others perceive the anti-busing crusade and those who are loudest in their damnation of busing as racist. And for many, the fact that it is a racist activity, this shrill anti-busing campaign, is enough to establish the validity of busing as a means of improving the nature and the context of our national lives. Now, all of us like to be on the side of the angels. But I think we, all of us, owe it to ourselves and the community to look beyond the fact that the anti-busing group is, in fact, a racist organization, and that those who are shrillest and meanest and orneriest in this issue are precisely those who are most racist. It's important for us to look more clearly at the issue, to see what its pluses are and its minuses are, what its possibilities are, and the things it cannot accomplish. And on that basis of that kind of hopefully dispassionate observation, analysis, make up our own mind just where we stand. Those who argue for major busing programs in order to achieve racial balance in schools. In other words, those who argue that we ought to be busing more children than we're busing now, and for a new reason, make two essential arguments. The first is that it's the law. That it's the right. It's a right of youngsters to be bused, a right under the Equal Protection Amendment, Amendment 14 to our Constitution. And secondly, they argue that it is a way to achieve quality education. That an integrated school is by nature a better school than a segregated school. Now let's examine both of those arguments. Is it in fact a right, the law, that throughout a school district there must be a relatively even or an absolutely even distribution of black and white students? And the answer is no. There is no law to that effect. What the courts have ruled up to this point is simply that when a school is found liable of having encouraged racial segregation, and when it has not been affirmatively active in eliminating racial desegregation, then some remedy must be proposed in order to spread out the children so that schools will not be voluntarily desegregated. And that's a far cry from the absolutist statement. There must be an exact proportion of black and white students in all schools in a given district. That's manifestly impossible, but obviously much more can be done than is being done now. And what of the second argument? The argument that a desegregated school, an integrated school, is by nature, by definition, a better school. A school which gives more to its youngsters than one which is segregated. Those who tend to make this argument categorically argue that any school which does not reflect the racial heterogeneity of the community, by definition, is failing to educate its children for life in that community. And obviously there's a good measure of truth in that. But those who take a more traditional position as to the purposes of education, who are concerned not only with human relations, but with the issue of reading and of writing and of the various skills which a school is supposed to make possible for the youngsters, they're not quite so sure. The evidence is not clear. There is no evidence as yet, they say, that busing children into another school, in fact, increases their proficiency at the basic language or mathematical skills. James Coleman, a sociologist at the University of Chicago, whose 1966 report to the United States Department of Education was largely responsible for the suggested remedy of busing as a solution to the problems of racial integration and as a contribution to better and more qualified education, for better quality education in the United States, has, as you know, gone back on that recommendation. He has done so for two reasons. The first, a pragmatic one. When northern school systems have been ordered to bust in any major way, he claims that this has only encouraged white flight from the system, and that practically this solution is self-defeating because it succeeds only in resegregating the children in the center city school district. There's simply less whites around to integrate into the system. The response to this by the NAACP and others is that white flight has been a fact of life in the northern cities for some 25 years, almost since the end of the Second World War, and that there is no proof that school desegregation decisions have in any significant way increased the long-term impact of white flight. They may temporarily speed it up, but it is simply speeding up something that would take place in any case. White flight preceded the school desegregation decision, and it will follow. It exists even in cities in which these decisions have not been rendered. The second argument which Coleman makes is this, that when he submitted his data in 1966, which seemed to show that if small numbers of children from center city neighborhoods were bused into more affluent neighborhoods, if black children were put into white schools, there was some measurable increase in their learning achievement. The further refinement of this data turned on the issue of race, but turns on the issue of class. That if, in fact, children from poorer neighborhoods, be they black or white, are bused into areas which have more affluent schools, with a smaller school pupil-teacher ratio, with better facilities, with children from a different kind of home, there is a measurable, perceptible improvement in their achievement. But if one simply measures the achievements of those who move from poor white neighborhoods into poor black schools, and from poor white neighborhoods into poor black neighborhoods into poor white schools, there is no measurable improvement. And what he's saying here is simply that desegregation within a class does not improve the quality of education for the children of that class. You've got to cross class lines, which is one of the reasons that many are now beginning to try and find legal ways to impose metropolitan solutions rather than simply solutions which would involve the central school district. Now, the issue of social science data as far as quality education is very difficult to come by and very problematic. One of the unfortunate outcomes of all of this passion has been that there have become party lines in the social sciences. And people have set out not to do the academic work, which is to find out what the data is and let the data fall where it may, but to prove a case, to prove that desegregation through busing works, or to prove that desegregation through busing does not work. And it's worth your life if you're a social scientist like Dr. Coleman to try and simply state what you find as the facts, because you may be stepping on somebody else's cherished ideas. In any case, I've tried to understand the data which has been submitted. And in order to try and extract myself and my own opinion from this data, I'd like to quote to you from a summary which was prepared by a group in Cleveland called the Ad Hoc Coordinating Council. This is a group of blacks and whites, most of whom, all of whom as far as I know, are committed to desegregation, and most of whom are committed to busing as a means of improving the racial mix and quality education, which was convened by the Greater Cleveland Interchurch Council. And they began some months ago to publish relevant data in this whole area. They've done some very excellent pieces of work. In December of last year, they published a bulletin on the outcomes of desegregation, in which they quoted from a book by a professor, Nancy St. John, on school desegregation outcomes for children, which I'd like to read you a paragraph. And then they quote, they list 11 research results from some 120 studies which they went through. And as you'll see, it's quite a mixed bag. It sees neither improving the quality of education inevitably occurs, nor in disproving that quality of education is in fact improved. And here's a quote from Professor St. John. During the past 20 years, considerable racial mixing has taken place in schools, but research has produced little evidence of dramatic gains for children and some evidence of genuine stress for them. The probable reason for such outcomes is that desegregation is rarely true integration. In other words, it is rarely implemented in ways that give minority children equal status and full protection against victimization and cultural marginality. But although desegregation is not to date a demonstrated success, is not yet a demonstrated failure. There is as little evidence of consistent loss as there is of consistent gain. Further, in spite of large numbers of studies, various limitations in design weaken the best of them. Thus, in a sense, the evidence is not all wrong. These are the 11 seeming conclusions from the social science studies which have so far been made. One, white achievement scores have been unaffected generally. Two, the gap in black-white achievement has not closed very much. Three, black achievement has sometimes risen and almost never fallen. Four, improvement for black children has most often occurred in the early grade, in arithmetic, and in schools which are over 50% white. Five, biracial schooling seems to have some negative effect on both academic self-concept and general self-concept of black children. Six, desegregation apparently lowers educational and vocational aspirations of black children, although some suggest that this is a reduction of unrealistically large aspirations. Seven, some evidence suggests in the long run desegregation may encourage the aspiration, self-esteem, and sense of control for black children. Eight, white racism is frequently aggravated by mixing schooling. Nine, interracial friendships are more likely among younger children than among those who have been desegregated for a long time. 10, great variation exists between communities on the interaction of secondary school students. 11, Interracial behavior is affected by social class. Middle-class whites and blacks seem more likely to form interracial friendships. Now, that's a mixed bag, if there ever was one. It suggests that not only that we don't know, but that for every positive achievement of integrated schooling, there's some loss. Either lost in self-esteem or lost in a growing sense of the need to defend oneself against whichever is the dominant community in the school. There are a number of high schools in the land where essentially those children now go to school in an interracial way. It's as if there are two schools operating in one building. Like there's no real myth of the youngsters, socially or otherwise, only under, you know, arbitrary administrative design in the classrooms or on the athletic field. It suggests, in other words, that one cannot really make the argument that busing is a contribution to quality education. Busing may be right under the law and may be necessary for the improvement of the social fabric, but as an educational end, it is hard defended in any major way. Obviously, in many situations, busing is a contribution. It's a contribution when you're busing for a specific purpose which cannot be achieved otherwise. But now again, in purely educational terms, busing is not necessarily a contribution to better education. Which is to suggest, I would submit, that the argument which must be made for busing is a purely legal or constitutional one. The busing is either necessary under the Constitution or not required by the Constitution to achieve a racial mix in the school. And that the reason that school systems, like the school system in Cleveland, have gone to court and allowed themselves to be brought to court on the busing issue is because they cannot, as teachers, really justify busing as a major contribution to better education. And because as administrators and the board, they see the consequences of a major busing system. The anger of the racists, the political turmoil which often, as in Boston, sweeps out moderate groups in control of the school system and sweeps in the most virulent of the races. They see the loss of public support, which means the defeat of future school levies. They see the concerns of economics. They're going to end up financing General Motors rather than financing better pay for their teachers. Of new equipment for the class. As all of you know, busing is the kind of issue which faces us with heartache. Obviously, there are no clear lines to take. In a city like Cleveland, the one thing that seems self-evident is that if busing is mandated by the court, busing given only the city school district will be disastrous to apply. For the Cleveland school population is now drawn largely from the lowest classes in our metropolitan area, the lowest and the least educated and the most likely to take the streets. There is the Cuyahoga River, a large industrial emptiness between the east side and the west side to overcome. If you notice, the school board here was not the only defendant in the NAACP case. There are two defendants, the city school system and the state of Ohio. For clearly an attempt is being made in Cleveland as elsewhere to maintain that it is ultimately the state which has responsibility for drawing school district lines, and that since it has this authority, it can redraw school district lines. And clearly, if we were to draw a metropolitan school district for Cuyahoga County, there would be an infinite number of new possibilities arising for busing, site solutions, and others to the problem of racial integration. The county school system, the metropolitan school district, would be less than 22% black. The city school district is well over twice that. Particularly on the east side, there would be ways of tearing through so that one could assure some significant black-white mix without lengthy busing across town. It's not clear that this decision is one which can, which will stand the test of law. Judge Roth in Detroit, the federal judge who heard the Detroit decision, attempted to impose, as you know, a metropolitan busing decision. And that decision was stricken down by the Supreme Court on technical grounds. The grounds being that the various suburban systems which were brought into Judge Roth's remedy had not in fact been stipulated as parties to the case and therefore could not be under a forced system made party to the remedy. Whether courts will impose this kind of metropolitanization of their desegregation decision remains to be seen. Where do I stand on busing? We've always had busing. And really, the issue cannot be raised in that theoretical way. Everyone is in favor of busing and always has been. The question is, where do you stand on the position of busing in order to achieve racial desegregation? And here I think the answer, for me at least, is this. If the courts will mandate such busing, I'm in favor of it. It has become, this remedy has become the law of the land. No great harm has been done to the school population through the years because they are bused long distances. My children spend 45 minutes to an hour every morning and every night on a school bus, and I haven't seen in any way that it has limited their educational experience or their educational opportunities. If the courts mandate busing, I'm in favor, but I hope and pray that the courts will not become too consistent in the matter. It's such a thing as a foolish consistency. And I hope and pray that they will not simply demand that all the school systems put all the children on buses and move them about here and there throughout the country, throughout the city or throughout the community. If there is a metropolitan solution, and I hope that's ultimately that what will come. What we need to do is to begin slowly and deliberately to see what possibilities exist. The bus where busing makes sense, create new magnet schools and special interest schools when these make sense, to see to it that teacher placement is not along racial lines when this is at all possible. But by and large, given the evidence that we now have at hand, it seems to me that busing is not the best, though it may be the simplest solution to the problems of national desegregation of our national life. Perhaps it's an important lever to achieve that end. But by itself, unless we're willing to force the desegregation of our racist neighborhoods, by itself, busing will not solve the problem. We have to learn to live together, to cooperate together. And I think all of us have to learn that a certain amount of congregating together is natural to human beings. We have to learn how to define pride and community, ethnic pride or racial pride in the true sense of community, and both of these coexisting at the same time. I don't know what Judge Bashisi will rule in the case that is now before him. If he does rule that the school system is liable, and I presume that he will, the remedy that is proposed, I hope, will include a variety of tools, variety of techniques to achieve the end of desegregation. That we'll recognize that absolute desegregation is not possible given the state of American society as to this moment in time. Now that's an answer which is no answer. And I don't mean it to sound equivocal. But it seems to me that we have to make progress on the community front at all levels simultaneously. And that it's easiest, obviously, to deal with a school system which has a legal responsibility rather than with the housing patterns where there are a whole series of individual patterns and individual prerogatives involved. It's very easy to forget that implicit within this whole issue is an issue of class, which we Jews, we Americans, tend to overlook. I say we Jews and we Americans because we look at this morally. And we look at, as Jews, we accept the proposition that we have all one father and one God has created us all and we are all equal. But in terms of class, there are differences of class. Things that are conditioned into children in the street which are not conditioned into children in other streets. And one cannot simply and arbitrarily insist that these children from these various backgrounds mingle, and that having mingled, they will come to like and to work easily with each other. We have to overcome, as Americans, the issues which make for these class differentiations. We have to overcome the slum. We have to destroy the ugliness which is implicit in many of the ghettos of our center city. We have to encourage the support system, particularly the family, which hopefully makes it possible for all to achieve a well-defined justice. These are complex issues, and they will not be solved simply by ordering the massive movement of children here, there, and everywhere, though I must say in conclusion that the ordering of buses is a welcome contribution, a first step. If the busing which is demanded is not arbitrary and absolute, we cannot allow the school systems to be satisfied with simply continuing the patterns of racial discrimination, racial segregation, which have long existed. And if the court can force certain kinds of activity on the school, the creation of new special ability schools, the so-called magnet schools, the pairing of schools, the siting of schools in special areas, busing when this is desirable, we will have made a modest but useful contribution. And in a world which is not yet utopian, it is the modest movement forward which is often the most successful one, and the radical movement forward which is often the most counterproductive one. But if, dear friends, the courts do order that the city of Cleveland shall have massive busing as a solution, as a remedy to its history of racial segregation, I trust that all of us will be law-abiding. I trust that all of us will accept the decision. I trust that we will do all that we can to allow the decision to be carried out in as intelligent a way as possible, which means, dear friends, that we will need to lend our support towards the breaking of the 31 school districts which now exist in Cuyahoga County, towards the creation of a metropolitan system. The problem is now not a Jewish problem because there are no Jewish children in the city school system. But we, as citizens and as Jews, coming from the tradition which is ours, cannot sit back and allow the torment to be in Huff and in the West Side. We must do our share towards the solution of this problem. And that share must be, seems to me, open up as much as is educationally sound, all areas of the county, all areas of our community, to a truly desegregated school experience. God willing, that we will achieve it.